Members, we will call this meeting of the Education Finance Committee to order. Now, the first order of business will be the approval of the minutes from January 18th. Representative Fabian has moves approval of the minutes. Any corrections, additions, or changes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Our members today will be taking additional testimony on legislative priorities. The two groups we'll be hearing from today are the Association of Metropolitan School Districts as well as Minnesota's Future Initiative. So before we begin, are there any questions for members about today's agenda or the upcoming week? All right, seeing none, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and introduce yourself. Or ignore me and stare at your laptop and pretend I'm not talking to you.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, I'm Cecilia Rattel from the chamber, but I'm actually not testifying. I'm just helping doing technology right now.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I was confused, Ms. Rattel, because on the agenda we have AMSD as being the first. Okay, well, I shouldn't read what's in front of me because it's wrong, so we'll start. Welcome to the committee, sir, and if you could please state your name.
Thank you, Chair. Begin to take your
testimony.
Thank you. I'm Charlie Weaver. I'm with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and this just shows you how well business groups work together, Mr. Chair, because Chamber's representative has her computer, so she's helping load the presentation. What I'm going to talk about is the pamphlet you've got in your book today, and I apologize for some of the members who are at our morning meeting. This will be a little repetitive, but I'll try to keep it interesting nonetheless. What we're going to talk about is a report that we did 2 years ago with McKinsey, we being the Itasca Project and the Minnesota Business Partnership. The Business Partnership, just to give you a little background, is an organization made up of roughly 100 CEOs from the largest companies in the state. The purpose of the organization is to basically to grow jobs, to create a strong economy in Minnesota so we have a high quality of life. It's made up of members like Target and Best Buy and Cargill and 3M and General Mills and some of the most important companies in the world in many cases. We represent about 400,000 employees in Minnesota, work for the partnership, and over 2 million employees globally. So I think that's one thing tells you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, is that only 20% of the people who work for the companies that I work for actually work in Minnesota. Only 20%. In many cases, in Cargill's case, for example, most of their employees don't even work in this country. 5% in many cases of their employees are here in Minnesota. So what that tells you, and really what the theme of my presentation today, is that we are now living in a global economy. It's a global economy where our companies here in Minnesota, we don't compete. When I served in your position in the legislature, we were competing with South Dakota and Iowa and Wisconsin and maybe Texas, maybe Washington. But that's just not true anymore. Now the companies that I work with are competing in India and China. So it's really a global perspective now in terms of growing jobs, which is why we need to take a global perspective when it comes to education. And that's what I wanted to talk to you about.
Well, Mr. Weaver, just a quick question. You said you served in the legislature. Were you a staff member or an intern? Or
I interned here, yeah. Back when I was in high school. I was pretty bad at that, too, Mr. Chair. No, I served for 10 years representing Anoka, Champlin, Coon Rapids back in the 80s. Thank you. So let me just give you a little background in terms of the report. Let me start out just by repeating, if you asked any of our CEOs, and again, the people I work with are some of the best CEOs in the world. They run the biggest companies in the world. If you ask them, what keeps you up at night? What do you worry about? You've got all these jobs in Minnesota. They would tell you what they worry most about is whether they're going to have a workforce 5 years from now, 10 years from now, to keep their companies in Minnesota. The quality of the workforce is the most important thing to our members, and I think to the business community in general. If you ask the chamber guys, they'd tell you the same thing. There's nothing more important than growing jobs in Minnesota than a highly educated, skillful workforce. So I think to start out the discussion, we can all agree on that. That if we're going to grow jobs, and that's kind of what all of you ran on, it's what the governor ran on, it's what legislators ran on, it's growing jobs. There's nothing more important from our perspective than a good education, quality education, if we're going to continue to grow jobs. A few years ago, there was a study done where they were, because it's a global economy, if you read Tom Friedman and The World is Flat, he talks about a global economy. There's a lot of concern about, is the United States going to be able to compete? Can our workers compete in this new global economy? So a study was done back in 2005 called Losing Our Competitive Advantage, and their conclusion was, if our workers are going to compete in a world economy that's knowledge-based and driven by technology, our education system has to change. We can't keep doing the same things over and over again that we've done for years and years in this country when it comes to education and expect to compete in this new global economy. Let me talk a little bit about where we are in Minnesota. There's some good news, and I think all of us, everyone here, can take credit for this. We are above average when it comes to competition within the United States. Our fourth and eighth graders were near the top in their reading achievement. Based on the most recent NAEP studies, we've got the highest ACT scores in the country, and that's been true for a number of years. We have among the best high school graduation rates in the country, and then more recently, the TIMSS study showed that Minnesota fourth graders had three times the gain in mathematics than the U.S. and as a whole. So, and I would suggest to you the reason we had this great gain, by the way, in mathematics was we set high standards and we held people accountable. And as a result, you saw a significant improvement compared to the rest of the world for fourth grade math recently. So all is not lost in Minnesota. We've got a pretty good record till now, but we've got some challenges. We are losing ground in some areas, and these are just a few of those statistics. 40% of the class of 2008, in other words, those who graduated from a high school in Minnesota in 2008, who attended public 2 or 4 year college, needed remedial courses. That is ridiculous. When you think about the waste of money that 40% of our kids who are graduating from Minnesota high schools need remediation when they show up at a 2 or 4 year institution, we should be ashamed of that. It's really expensive. It's a waste of time. We need to hold people accountable. And that number, by the way, has gotten worse. So we aren't, the trajectory is not that we're getting better. We're getting worse. A couple of years ago, it was 38%. So that represents 13,000 kids in Minnesota who are showing up to our colleges unprepared. And these are not kids from the inner city. You might typically think are more challenged, have a tough time. 23% of the kids who graduated from Edina high schools, 23% are showing up in the need of remediation. In my area where I'm from, Anoka, Coon Rapids, it's 45% of the kids graduating need remediation. So that's a significant challenge. That was just released 2 days ago. It's a study by Minsky and the University of Minnesota. We have the second largest achievement gap, as this committee knows, between white and minority students. That's ridiculous. Only 3%, maybe this is the most startling statistic of these four, 3% of Minnesota's African American and American Indian ninth graders will ultimately get a bachelor's degree by the time they're 26. That's criminal. That's criminal. That few kids are getting their degree. And we know in this new society that we're in, we can't count on those kids to go get jobs in kind of a strong back jobs. When I was growing up, you could go out and you could work with your back. You didn't really need a high school diploma. That's just not true anymore now. You'll hear from Peter Hutchinson about the kind of change in demographics and what we need from our kids. But bottom line is, in this new economy, you need a college degree. And the fact that so many of our minority students aren't even close is something we need to look at. And then last, when you compare our eighth graders to 41 countries around the world, Minnesota's 19th, which is not good. It's not enough to compete. And the U.S. is even worse at 24th. So on the one hand, we can be proud of some of the statistics that bear fruit or that are currently true in Minnesota, but we've got significant challenges and we're going backwards in many ways. Now, the Minnesota Business Partnership, our principles, and we were really formed 30 years ago around the issue of education. That's why the CEOs of these major companies at the time, it was Dayton's, Honeywell, Pillsbury, got together. And the reason they got together was education. So our organization has been focused on education for the whole time of our existence. And the principles that we've set over the years around education reform are four. Number one, set high world-class standards. And this legislature has done a good job there. I think if you look at Minnesota, I'll talk about that in a second, compared to the rest of the world, this is one where we do well. We do have high standards. Second, report on them. if you're going to set them, then measure them, report on them individually and by school on a uniform basis. Third, give local educators the flexibility to do their work to achieve a result. So don't tie their hands so they can't do their job. We talked a little bit about that this morning's committee hearing. Give them the flexibility they need to offer the programs that ultimately get results. And then last, give them choice. Give parents the choice to choose a program that works best for them. So those are kind of the four principles for reform that the partnership has embraced over the years, and the legislature to some extent has embraced, oops, as well. This should be fun. Just click it. Oh, which one? I don't want to do that. Help me, Cecilia. So when you have a lawyer trying to do computer work, it's really bad. Thank you.
If only there was a computer guy.
If only there was a computer guy. So that's the challenge, and those are our principles. So 2 years ago, the partnership, along with Itasca, said, if the challenge is education, if education is so important to growing jobs, how are we doing? And if it's a global economy, how are we doing compared to the best systems in the world? So we asked McKinsey to do the work, the research, around those two questions. Number one, how does our education system compare with the best systems in the world? Because our goal is to have the best education system in the world. I think all of us, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, we can agree that our goal is to have the best education system in the world here in Minnesota. So number one question was, how do we compare? And number two, what can we learn? Where's the gap, and what do we need to do to catch up? So those are the two questions that we posed in the report that's in front of you. Now, the good news that McKinsey found when they did this report, and they looked at school systems all around the world and figured out which ones are performing the best, was that we're doing pretty well in two areas. Academic standards, as I said before, and assessments were very strong and continue to be strong. Minnesota does well. Second, our funding system is stable, it's predictable, it's adequate, and it's equitable. When you look, and specifically on page 11 of the brochure that you've got in front of you, it talks about the funding system here, and what they found in their McKinsey's research was the United States, as a country, spends more than any other country in the world on education. No country spends more than we do. And yet we get poor results. We get poor results. In Minnesota, you can argue there's Census Bureau information, other information that shows Minnesota is in the top third in terms of what we spend. But as a country, we spend more than any other nation in the world on education. Yet our results are weak. And we do not perform compared to other countries who spend a lot less and get much better results. But our funding system here in Minnesota is very equitable compared to a lot of other states. We are not, you know, the system we've adopted in Minnesota over the years is that the quality of your education shouldn't be dependent on how much money, how wealthy your district is, and we've embraced that. And this study found, in terms of equity, Minnesota does a nice job.
Excuse me, Mr. Weed, we have a question. Representative Endlich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I listened to your words, and I'm trying to digest your handout. On the one hand, you say that education funding in Minnesota is three very wonderful things. It's sufficient, it's reliable, and it's predictable, but then you go on to use special education as underfunded. How can we have an underfunded population and service to Minnesota children and then claim that the funding is sufficient?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry if I didn't say this. I didn't mean to mention special ed.
But you do in your handout.
Which
you use special education as an example.
Page 12.
Okay. Thank
of an underfunded, you use the word mandate.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get the connection between underfunding a service and a population and then claiming that funding for public schools is sufficient, reliable, and predictable. I find that stunning.
Mr. Weaver.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't think it's inconsistent to say that on the whole, as a country and as a state, we adequately fund K-12. If you look at the data, the United States provides more money per pupil than any other country in the world, and yet our results are less. In Minnesota, compared to the rest of the country, depending on, I understand the census recently revised some of their data, but we're clearly one of the top funded states in the nation. Now, special education, I think you and I would agree, the federal government hasn't lived up to their promise around special education. Clearly they haven't. And as a result, there's some shifting within the schools on education, on special ed, because they're funding special ed with regular ed dollars. But that doesn't mean as a whole that we're overall, that we're underfunded.
Representative Enzo? Okay. Please continue, Mr. Weaver.
Thank you. So,
excuse me, Mr. Weaver, we do have another question. Representative Greiley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and Representative Weaver, to nice continue to our conversation from this morning. Representative Anzels brought up something I hadn't even noticed in the handout before, but I'm glad you tempered your statement so they weren't quite so strong about funding not mattering, because we're so well funded in our country, but yet we have bad results. But I do think that Representative Anzell's point is pertinent, because, you know, when you say we have stable and funding and we have adequate funding, it doesn't take into account special ed. And it's not just the federal government that hasn't lived up, never even getting to half of their 40% promise, but it's also the state of Minnesota, where we have something like $600 million of a cross-subsidy and roughly equivalent to every levy referendum in the state added together, so that districts are having to go out, raise property taxes just to fund special ed, and that does skew the picture. We had a chart from Mr. Hutchinson this morning from the Bush Foundation, and he just haplessly picked the date 1974 to prove that, to look at how much money on the curve we have going up. But people like Representative Erickson and me, who were teaching in 1974, know that that's when special ed started being mandated by the federal government, and that meant that special ed has to be paid for first before any other funding. But if you don't take that into account when you're looking at how much money there is to schools, you don't realize that counting inflation and factoring out special ed and building expenses, then school funding has been flat in Minnesota since 1984. So it's always a constant trying to educate people, because we have this mindset in the state of Minnesota that, we can have constitutional amendments for the environment and the arts, and we need to make sure we fund this, that, and the other thing, but that education has all the money, gets all the money, and is fine. And we can keep on giving them nothing and then asking schools to do more and more and more. So I think you've hit upon a sore spot, that we're just ready to leap as soon as someone says there's plenty of money, but here's what we want to be done, or we want this accountability. And I don't know any legislators that don't want the reforms and the accountabilities, but it's just the idea that I think sometimes comes, I think, from the business community, that we can do all those things and the funding is fine. As soon as I hear that, I just leap to my feet, and you can see it that I do that.
And, Mr. Chair,
Mr. Weaver.
Garling, and I appreciate it when you leap to your feet. You should leap to your feet. And maybe what we can argue numbers, and do you use the consumer price index? What do you use to come at numbers? But bottom line is, I think the other chart on page 12 also shows that we can probably do better, regardless of how much we've got. We can probably do a better job of getting it to the kids, getting into the classroom. If you look at the numbers comparing Minnesota, the United States, to other countries in terms of how much goes to administrative costs and how much gets ultimately to the teachers, we don't do so well there either. So maybe that's one thing we can agree on, that at least we've got a set amount of money given the budget challenges. Let's at least make sure we get as much as possible into the classroom.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Weaver, then are you saying that when there is money, you do agree we need more for our kids?
I think we need to be really smart. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling. No, given the data, no. I mean, the data would suggest that we're spending a ton of money right now compared to other countries that beat the pants off us in terms of results. And by the way, those other countries we're comparing ourselves to, they do factor out for special ed. They do factor out for challenged kids. They do. So we aren't comparing ourselves apples to oranges. We're comparing apples to apples in terms of these other countries and their test results. So if they don't include special ed in their test results, they aren't included in the McKinsey performance report. So, no, I'm not saying that. I'm thinking, but I do think we can be smarter about how we spend the money we do have. So, Mr. Chair, in terms of the four areas, because I want to make sure we get to Mr. Hutchinson, because he's really compelling, what does this report say in terms of how we can do better? There's really four areas that they found where we can do better. Teacher preparation is one, and that Mr. Hutchinson will talk about that. Recruiting top talent into high-needs areas is another one where we have a great opportunity. School leadership development, that is principal leadership development, and then using data better. Those are the four areas we can, this report concluded, if we do those four things better, we can make a significant improvement in Minnesota education. So what the business community did then, the partnership, Itasca, the Chamber of Commerce, Bush Foundation, other nonprofits pulled together and said, let's form an initiative then and figure out how to get at these four factors. If these are the four factors that can make the difference between a mediocre system and a world-class system, then let's get at them. So we have over the last couple of years. Let me give you a quick progress to date around principal leadership. We have partnered with a couple different programs. Joe Nathan's program over at McAllister, he deals with charter school principal education. And then Kent Pickell at the University of Minnesota has got a good program helping principals get better at what they do. Really, the way we principals become principals in this state, they don't get the kind of training that they need. And I think most principals would agree with that statement. They don't get a lot of help around developing budgets. They don't get help around leadership. They don't get help around team building or personnel management or facilities management, all the things that we'd expect principals to get when they've got this precious commodity in their hands. They don't get it. It's like dumping someone and say, you run the Target store in Champlin, right? And you've never run anything in your life, but we expect them to do it. So the efforts that are currently going around principal leadership are important, but challenges, how do you bring them to scale? How do you bring them to scale? It's just a tiny fraction of our principals who've currently had access to those kind of programs. So we've got to figure that out. And we've worked with both of those gentlemen. We've provided mentors, CEOs who've agreed to mentor principals in different schools. That's been very effective. And the principals and our CEOs have really enjoyed that program. We've provided them with facilities. We've provided them with speakers. So we're working on that. Data is also critical. Basically, you can't improve what you don't measure. If we don't measure things, we don't know how to make them better. It's true, certainly, in teaching and education. It's certainly true in business. And we don't do a good job in Minnesota of linking data with anything. We've got a bunch of data, but we don't hook it up. So helping the department finish their longitudinal data study was really important, and we've made progress there. Third, generating community support for the Race to the Top. It was the best example of bipartisan cooperation that I've seen in 20 years in Minnesota. We had the two mayors. We had the governor. We had unions. We had business. We had the chamber. We had rural. We had metro. We had downtown. Everyone, nonprofits, were supported our Race to the Top application, and that was a significant step forward in coming together around the need for education reforms. It's unfortunate, ultimately, we didn't get the Race to the Top money, but it pulled the groups together to align around how do we do a better job here. So that's also been significant and I think consequential too. And then last, and Peter will talk mostly about this, the teacher preparation part, the Bush Foundation is doing terrific work. You'll hear about that in a second. Also, our corporation raised about $3 million to bring Teach for America to Minnesota. That's been successful, although it's just a drop in the bucket in terms of what we need overall. And then your efforts in this committee and others to pass alternative teacher licensure, we've been supportive of that as well. So, Mr. Chair, those are the kind of the four challenge areas. That's what we've been doing in these three. And now, unless there's questions, I'd be happy to turn over to Mr. Hutchinson, who could talk about how we get the best teachers in the classroom.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Mr. Hutchinson, if you could please come down. And members, my understanding is that Mr. Hutchinson has to leave at 1:30, if that's correct. Am I correct? Okay. So members, if we could please hold our questions until, I'd really like to hear all of Mr. Hutchinson's presentation, and then we'll come back to questions if that's okay with members. So thank you very much.
wait for that technical.
Of course. And I believe we have copies of Mr. Hutchinson's presentation that are going to be passed out. Is that correct?
Yeah, while they're figuring this out, let me start with just a little introduction about the Bush Foundation, myself, and kind of what we're up to. The Bush Foundation, just quickly to remind you, was founded by Archibald Bush, who was a sort of a wayward son of a farm family in Granite Falls. And had asthma, so he ends up in Duluth, enrolls in what was called the Duluth Business College and gets himself a degree in accounting. Halfway through, he gets a call from a guy who has a job, and he ends up working for a guy for McKnight, named McKnight, and the two of them ended up running 3M together for 46 years. And it's a wonderful accident that this guy had asthma and that 3M worked. And we're all the beneficiaries of the two of them did, the McKnight Foundation and the Bush Foundation. For myself, just a little quick background, I started out actually at what was called the Dayton Hudson Corporation. It doesn't exist anymore. It's now called Target. Served for a little while as the Commissioner of Finance for the state, was the Superintendent of Schools in Minneapolis, and now get to do this. And in 2006, I went out and tried to convince you all out of your governor, but you made a better decision. But I want to tell you a story about that. I was in Deer River. Wandered into a bar in Deer River because I figured there's votes in bars. Turned out I was wrong about that, but you go where you turn, you know, you go.
But in that case, Mr. Hutchinson, there really was no downside to being wrong, was there? Let's proceed.
And I'm walking through the bar saying hi to people, and I approach this young woman who's sitting on a bar stool, and she twirls around. She says, "You lied to me." And I said, "I haven't even tried to convince you to vote for me. How could I have lied already?" And she says, "I don't mean you personally. I mean you adults." And I was really disturbed. And I said, what did we do?" And she said, "I did everything you told me to do. I went to school every day. Never missed. Did my homework every night. I got straight A's. I graduated with a Minnesota high school diploma. And then, like you all told me to do, I enrolled in college. And when I got there, remember, I had straight A's. I had a Minnesota high school diploma. They told me I had to take math and reading over again. That woman changed my life. That's the most depressing thing I can imagine happening to someone. And she clearly never recovered. I think that captures for me what it is this is about. When Charlie says that this is fundamentally an economic and jobs issue, that's exactly what it is. And for that young woman, her life trajectory was altered by the cataclysm of thinking she had accomplished something that she really hadn't accomplished, and finding out in the worst possible way that she had been denied the education she thought she deserved. Since Charlie did all the statistics, I want to start here. So at the foundation, the Bush Foundation's mission is to be a catalyst for the courageous leadership to solve our toughest public problems. And if there is a tough public problem, education achievement's got to be it. In my time as superintendent in Minneapolis, we tried all these reforms that you see here. And the truth is, most of them didn't work. Or they certainly didn't work well enough. And they obviously didn't work for that young woman. And we've done a lot of research over the last several years to try to understand what levers could make the biggest difference. And I'm not here to tell you there's a silver bullet. There's a lot of stuff we probably need to do. But I am here to focus on one of the strategies that we think makes a lot of sense. And this has to do with the next 25,000 teachers in our schools. We're at an amazingly special moment in Minnesota. In the next 10 years, half of our teachers are going to leave the classroom because they're getting old like me. They're going to retire. They're going to move on. They're going to find something else to do. And we're going to replace them. Half of all the teachers. What an opportunity. And what struck us was, well, could we affect who those next 25,000 teachers are? And if they were really fabulous, would it make a difference? Well, it would make a difference.
This happens to be from Tennessee. And the research here is really straightforward. Take a group of kids that are at the 50th percentile at age 8, so they're in third grade. Now give them the best 20% of the teachers in your schools for 3 years. So these are the teachers that contribute the most to learning, top 20%. 3 years later, that group of kids that was at the 50th percentile is at the 90th percentile. We'd wish this for our kids. Everyone would want this for their kids. Same research. Start with another pool of very similar kids at the 50th percentile. Give them 3 years of the bottom 20% in terms of teacher effectiveness for 3 years in a row. They end up at the 37th percentile. And what this graph doesn't show you is that they don't recover. 3 years of ineffective teaching in a row is a death sentence in education. It makes a gigantic difference who that next 25,000 teachers are. And it makes a particularly big difference for the kids who start out the furthest behind. So on this graph, on the right-hand side are a bunch of fourth graders that are the highest performing in fourth grade. The middle group are the middle performing, and the left-hand group are the lowest performing. The importance of the colors are that the light colors are students that got three effective teachers in a row. And the dark colors are the ones that got three ineffective teachers in a row, or less effective teachers in a row. Well, you can see for those highest performing fourth graders, it does matter whether you got effective or ineffective teaching, but not a lot. Those high performing kids do pretty well, almost in spite of who we put in front of them. But flash to the left-hand side of the screen where you can see that effective teachers with the most challenged kids can virtually close the gap in achievement by raising their scores. So it's not just that effective teachers matter for all kids. They matter the most for the kids who need it most. Well, that got us kind of jazzed at the foundation, thinking, wow, if it really makes that much difference, this is something worth pursuing. And so we've focused our attention on this 25,000, on the 50% of teachers that are going to be replaced. And we're not replacing them. You're not replacing them. But they're going to get replaced. It's just the natural order of things. Now, what do we mean by an effective teacher? People can have lots of definitions. In the work we're choosing to do, we say an effective teacher is a teacher that moves a student a year's worth every year. It's a simple idea. Kid comes into your classroom at reading at the third grade level, they should go out of your classroom reading at the fourth grade level. By the way, in that same classroom, if a kid comes in at the second grade level, they should go out, I'd love them to go out reading at the fourth grade level, but they should at least go out reading at the third grade level. They should at least move a year's worth every year. But that's the definition we're using. We're not trying to impose this on other people. But we've said that's a minimum. There are other measures of success and so on that we can use. But at a minimum, kids ought to get a year's worth of learning for a year in school. The second important thing about teacher preparation that we learned is that we prepare a lot more teachers in Minnesota than we hire. Lots more. And after about 5 years, we're really getting less than 50% of the teachers we prepare end up in our schools. So we have a system that is kind of over-preparing teachers in general, preparing way too many elementary school teachers, by the way, and probably not enough STEM and other high needs teachers. But in general, the system is producing more teachers than we need, and then once they get hired, the system is then throwing a whole bunch of them out. You can think about it as sort of a human resources, human capital design. This is a very inefficient system, and it's treating a whole bunch of people really badly. So for our work, we focused on these five dimensions of preparation. First, the preparation programs themselves. So what exactly goes on when we are preparing a teacher? A second is the tools to assess the effectiveness of teachers and the programs that prepared them. It's really important if we're going to have effective teachers, we need to have effective teacher preparation programs. So we want to be able to have the tools available to us. Thirdly, marketing. One of the things we learned the hard way is that we're doing almost nothing to recruit people into teaching. And if we want the greatest, if we want the best, we got to go find them and we got to bring them in. So talking in a second about some marketing ideas we're pursuing. Teacher compensation. obviously going to be an important variable, and I'll share with you some of our data on that. And finally, there needs to be a policy environment that rewards the creation of effective teachers. This is where you come in, but it's also where local school boards come in and the policy boards for the higher education institutions. It's got to be, the incentive's got to be there. We can't just tell people they ought to do this. If they do it, something good ought to happen. And if they don't do it, by the way, something not so good ought to happen. We've put together something we call the Next Teacher Partnership. This is our network for excellence in teaching. And there's 14 higher education institutions that have joined this network. 11 of them are in Minnesota, and two in North Dakota and one in South Dakota. It includes the University of Minnesota. In the MinSTU system, it includes Winona and Mankato and Moorhead and St. Cloud. And then there are 6 private colleges that have come together in the Twin Cities to also be part of this work. What distinguishes these 14 institutions is that they've agreed to 2 really important things from our The first is they've agreed to use the data. They've agreed to create a data-rich environment in which teachers are prepared to use data, and the institutions themselves are prepared to use data to assess their own performance. But the most profound thing that they have agreed to is that they're going to guarantee to the K-12 districts that hire their teachers, they're going to guarantee the effectiveness of the people in those classrooms. And that means they're going to follow their graduates for up to 5 years to make sure that they're delivering those effective results in classrooms. This has never been done before in the country as far as we know. They're not required to do this. There's no law that makes them do it. They're doing it because they want to be part of the solution to educational challenges here in Minnesota. And I give these presidents a ton of credit for their courage. This is a really hard thing for them to do. They're stepping out there. They're talking directly to the school superintendents. They're making this commitment, and they're prepared to stand behind it. In fact, I was down in Rochester a couple weeks ago, and Judith Romaley, who's the president at Winona, gave a speech to the community and to the school board, and she articulated this guarantee, this promise to stand behind their teachers. She got a standing ovation, because she's willing to try and do something really hard that's going to make a huge difference. So when we think about the preparation process, what the institutions are focused on are 4 steps. First, recruiting. As I mentioned, we virtually don't recruit. In fact, for many of our institutions, we don't even have a picture of it in our minds of what a great teacher would be. Who are the students we'd like to have come in? In just a second, I'm going to show you some research we've done that actually gives us a lot of indication about who we should be recruiting. Admission standards. There ought to be some, and they ought to be high. If we want the very best, we've got to make it important to get in, but also hard enough to get in that you're likely to get a good graduate on the other end. The preparation process itself. So often, when I trained to be a teacher, most of my training was done in my college classroom. But of course, that's not where a teacher's ever going to work. The training mostly needs to be done in school classrooms, where young teachers can have the real experience of learning how to do teaching. Teaching is science plus art. And if you're not out there in the classroom, you might not even know early on whether you're really made out to be a teacher. Thirdly is placement. It really does matter where a young teacher ends up. You know, a young teacher with a good principal in a rich climate will grow and get to be better. And a young teacher put in a dysfunctional setting, they're not going to be in teaching very long. They're going to get driven out. And then finally is this thing about support. The institutions are going to provide up to 5 years of support for these new teachers. Again, never been done before. Huge commitment from the higher education institutions, this notion of a guarantee. We're also investing in assessment. We've got a deal worked out with the University of Wisconsin's Value-Added Research Center. These are some of the geniuses in the country on this. And what they're doing is constructing the ability to track an individual teacher's effectiveness in their classroom and then connect that back to the preparation institution. So each year, these preparing institutions are going to know how their teachers are doing, and of course the K-12s are going to know how they're doing. And they can actually call up the guarantee. They can say, "I got this math teacher here that's not quite making it. Come on down. I want to see you deliver." By the same token, those preparing institutions will be able to learn what parts of their curriculum are working, what's not working, what adjustments do they need to make over time. They'll get a lot of information about the quality of the recruiting they're doing. Are they really bringing the right people in the first place? One of the most exciting things about our work is that these 14 institutions have come together to create a common metrics, a system of common metrics to be able to track across all 14 institutions what's happening and how it's happening, so we'll learn together, not just individually, how it's going. I mentioned that we haven't been recruiting, and one of the things that's happened in the teacher preparation world is that whereas 40 years ago, if you were a woman in this society, you had like three job choices, and fortunately for people like me, those women, the really great women, chose teaching. And so the discriminatory labor market we had really worked out for a bunch of us. Well, then we got rid of all the discrimination, and guess what? Those brilliant women found other things to do in their careers. And today, we're actually pulling many of our teachers from the bottom of the SAT distribution, the bottom of the ACT distribution. Not because somebody said we should do that, because the K-12 world didn't actually compete for the talent. We just let it happen. When I go around and ask deans, you know, how do you do recruiting? They say, I open the door. Well, that's not going to do it. Not if you want the really greatest. So we did a bunch of research a couple years ago with high school students, young college students, and recent graduates to try to understand who's out there and what kind of people might be attracted to teaching. Actually, McKinsey did this research, and they ended up breaking the world down into these five groups. So starting at the bottom of this chart, there's the mercenaries who are kind of only in it for the money. There's the security seekers who are in it because they want safety. There's the reputationists because they want people to think well of them. There's the altruists, the people who want to do good in this world. And there's the change makers, people who want to make a difference. And those are roughly 20%. Each one is roughly 20% of the population out there on our campuses. And what is so interesting from this research is it is the change makers and the altruists that are most likely to go into teaching. And they're exactly the people we want in teaching. The real catastrophe is we're not out there recruiting them. And so what this has helped us understand is we know who to go after. And these people, the change makers in particular, are not hard to find. They are easy to find. They chair all the committees. They lead all the clubs. They're the rabble-rousers on campus. They're the ones who are already making a difference. They're probably who you were when you were on campus. But nobody asked them to think about teaching. And so what we're working with our campus partners to do is to create a statewide marketing campaign to attract these people into teaching while they do the marketing on campus to bring them in to their preparation program. Now, even if we're successful at all this, and I hope we are, there's a lot of other things that need to be in place if this is all going to be successful. So in the recruiting area, for example, we do have to recruit. We do need a marketing campaign. But we've also got to provide some financial incentives for people to teach, and particularly to teach in our toughest schools. And this is a place that you could come in, thinking about, are there ways we can create scholarship programs or write-off debt or tax credits or something to make it attractive? For the campuses, it's about admission requirements. You've got to raise the bar so that the most likely successful students get over that bar and get into these programs. On the preparation side, you know, the state has a lot of involvement in the approval of programs, who can train teachers in our state, the accreditation process, and even graduation requirements. What does it mean to get a diploma in teaching? And it needs to mean that you're effective. So one of the challenges, I think, is to look at our graduation expectations for teacher programs and make sure effectiveness, that is the ability to successfully deliver, is built into the standards. Then there's the support process. You know, those first 3 or 4 years of teaching are absolutely essential, like any job. You know, we can produce great teachers, but they get even greater in those first 3 or 4 years. So we want to make sure there's a supportive environment for that. So how we license teachers and how we tenure teachers can say a lot about whether effectiveness is the basis on which we do this. And if we make effectiveness part of the equation, we're, again, likely to get better results from the teacher programs. Data is another thing. Now, we're trying to knit this together, and the people at Madison are doing a great job. But there's some policy stuff that is important to be able to knit this data together in a way that will allow the teachers to know how they're doing, the K-12 systems to support them, and the preparation programs to be engaged in their long-term support. And then, of course, you know, these our work is an investment in the transformation of teacher preparations, but we don't run teacher prep programs. So how the financing system for teacher preparation happens and works in this state is important to whether or not we get the kind of teachers we want and whether the process is rewarding. So this is an issue for you all to think about. I told you we did some research on compensation. This comes up a lot. We were trying to understand for these new potential teachers and even for recent hires, what is it in compensation that could help make teaching more attractive? And what we learned was really kind of a surprise, frankly. We learned that the number one dimension of compensation that would help attract more people into teaching was performance pay. And it turns out it's not the amount of money so much that matters. It's the recognition for being successful. Remember, we're talking here to 18 to 22-year-olds. These are kids that were raised in a different generation than I was raised in, and they want to be, these are change makers. They want to be successful, and they want to be acknowledged for being successful. So for them, performance pay is as much about the recognition as it is about the money. The second thing is, interestingly, is not their starting salary, but the maximum. The question for them is not where am I going to begin, but how far can I go? So they're really looking 8, 9, 10 years down the road to see what that salary schedule looks like. They're much more interested in that. The third thing, of course, would be how long it takes to get to that that maximum. The fourth thing is professional development. So it turns out that these young people are so interested in making a difference, they want to keep investing in themselves. They want to see a compensation system that actually rewards them for getting better at what they do. And then fifth on the list is starting pay, which was a big surprise to us. But remember, we're talking about these change makers. They're thinking about the world differently. They're thinking about making a difference. They want to be recognized and supported for making that difference. As Charlie said, we're part of this Futures Initiative. You have, I think, in your stack of stuff, a thing called the Blueprint. And that's an accumulation of the ideas that our organizations have put together to think about what the kind of policy environment that would be the most successful and most helpful. So I commend that to you as you're going through the year. And I want to end with just a note about the K-12 role in all of this. So our focus has mostly been on these teacher preparation programs in the higher ed institutions. But they can't do this without K-12 partners. And I got to tell you, the most exciting thing about the work we've done over the last couple of years has been the way in which the higher ed institutions and the K-12s have come together. We have superintendents and principals and curriculum folks from the K-12 systems literally sitting across the table from deans and professors hashing out what a great teacher preparation program has to look like. We're on the verge of having situations where an individual school district might be able to say to one of the universities, you know, we can see down the road that we're going to need a bunch of ELL teachers, or we're going to need elementary special ed teachers, or we're going to need chemistry teachers, and actually have that higher education institution preparing those particular teachers. So it's not sort of a random act of finding each other, but actually starting to create a pipeline that delivers to schools the kind of teachers they actually need, instead of three times as many elementary teachers that anyone's ever going to hire, actually delivering the kind of teachers that we need to do the job. But it's equally important that the K-12 systems be demanding in this process. They have to demand quality teachers. They have to be clear about what it takes to succeed in their schools. They have to say to the higher education institutions, you know, if you can't deliver those students, I'll find a higher education institution that will. They have to be just as demanding on the sort of receiving side as the higher eds have to be in the recruiting side. And if we can knit this together, we end up with something that doesn't exist anywhere else in the country as far as we know, which is a kind of a seamless process for recruiting young people into teaching, actually recruiting old people into teaching, delivering them prepared to be effective, and then supporting their success over time. That kind of seamless system, if we put that together in Minnesota, it would change the trajectory of education. This to me is a once in a lifetime opportunity. I've never, in all my time in Minnesota, and especially my time as superintendent, there never was a moment like this where we actually think have an opportunity to knit together the entire education establishment to produce the kind of teachers we need and to change the trajectory of education. Not only to make sure everybody does well, but that those who are doing the least well get caught up. And as you know, that hasn't been done anywhere. We got a shot at it. At least we got an opportunity. But it's going to take all of us. It's going to take Charlie and his crew. It's going to take organizations like ours. It's going to take the K-12 folks. It's going to take the unions. It's going to take the communities. It's going to take the state. But why not? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Excellent testimony, Mr. Hutchinson, and thank you. Can you stick around just for a little bit? I've got quite a few questions. So Representative Erickson, was your question for Mr. Hutchinson?
Well, either for Mr. Weaver or Mr. Hutchinson, because I didn't get to ask you this morning. Did you look at the teacher preparation programs and the preparation for principals, or did your group look at some of the specifics involved for this group to determine that work needs to be done?
Mr. Hutchinson.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Representative Erickson, yes, we've looked at the principal preparation, and I don't think it's being uncharitable to say that as much as we need to change, the fundamentally transform what we're doing with teachers, we need to do that times 2 or 12 or something when it comes to principals. We have sort of a non-system system, and we need to strengthen it, and the same principles would apply. Mm-hmm. Recruit well, mm-hmm. train well, have standards, get data, a guarantee effectiveness, build accountability in, and we know from talking to the prospective teachers, if we don't deliver them into buildings with great principals, they're not going to be around. So we need both.
And Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. And gentlemen, I think you know this. Principals in Minnesota have tenure, so we have to look at that too, I think.
Representative Brynan, is your question for Mr. Hutchinson or Mr. Weaver?
For Mr. Hutchinson.
Okay, Representative Brynan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hutchinson, you talked about the definition of teacher effectiveness being the measure of 1 year student academic growth, and on the you also talked about all the work that's being done about value added at the University of Wisconsin. I just want you to put those two discussions together, because when you say that teacher effectiveness is defined by 1 year of student academic growth, it sounds as though we already know how to achieve that measure, that we have that answer, and yet the work that's being done on value added, from what I understand about it, is a ways out from having that measure defined in a way where we can make the link to teacher performance in a way that guarantees the result. And my concern is that we don't put the cart before the horse in making that linkage in terms of defining teacher effectiveness.
Mr. Hutchinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, actually the work on value added is well along. In reading and in mathematics, it's coming quite quickly in science and the other elementary disciplines, even into middle school. The real challenges right now in value added are in high school, where the sequences are different, where you have a different challenge with connectivity. So we feel pretty confident, actually, that as we're moving along here, that we can begin as early as now, starting to assess the value added in elementary, certainly in reading and math, and that this work is expanding at such a rapid rate that we'll be in a pretty good position to gather data to assess effectiveness. Now, and I want to distinguish this from gathering data for accountability purposes. This is about gathering data to improve the effectiveness of individual teachers, of schools, and of the preparation programs. And so it's more of almost a research mindset that will allow this to evolve over time, and we'll get better and better at it. But we're well along. We have a ton of data in this state that we could be using. I remember as a school superintendent back in 1990, shows you how long ago it was and how old I am. 94, 95, I saw my first value-added report in the Minneapolis Public Schools that long ago. So we've been at this for a long time.
Representative Brenner?
Just a quick follow-up, and I don't expect a complete answer, but I know that the process has been around a long time and that we have a lot of data to work with, but I think you're exactly hitting on some of the reluctance to do the linkage between the data and the teacher, and that's what use is it being applied to in terms of building effectiveness, moving teachers forward to better performance. It's the carrot or the stick.
Exactly.
That's
and and to actually square that circle just a little bit more, one of the challenges on the teacher preparation side is that the preparation programs have done an incomplete job of preparing teachers to use data. And one of the requirements that we imposed was that that had to be in the curriculum. That we don't want to graduate any teachers that are data phobic. And
Mr. Hutchinson, like, is that a real word? Come on. Is that?
I actually think it might be.
It is now. Thank you. Any follow-up, Representative Briner? Thank you. Representative Slocum? No?
Nice you remembered my name, Mr.
Chair. Oh, thanks. That was it?
I don't have anything.
Oh, okay. All right. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you've kind of alluded to it already, Mr. Hutchinson, but this sense of the profile of the new teacher recruit seems to imply a little more than maybe just compensation. I'm thinking about the people I've hired in the past that I think fit that similar profile, and they want to be equipped, they want to have autonomy, they want to be held accountable for their outcomes, you know, kind of tools and supports. If there's a couple of things kind of within the complex of day-to-day classroom activity, I mean, are there a handful of things that we could change in the schools that would make the profession more attractive as a whole as compared to simply we're focused on the teacher prep curriculum and the approach to it, but just the profession as a whole, are there a handful of things that we could change in your research that would really make the profession more attractive to that type of person?
Mr. Hutchinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, yeah, I think that when you go and talk to new teachers, so these aren't the ones that are in the college classroom yet, but they're out now and they're in school, and you ask them, so what doesn't sync up? The number one thing is the principal. So who the first line supervisor is really matters, because it's all about climate and whether you're being supported, whether that individual kind of has an investment in your success. And the number two thing is the interest in their colleagues in growth and performance improvement. I'll give you the perfect example. I had coffee with a young woman over the weekend who's in her seventh year of teaching. There's no doubt that she's one of the great teachers in Minnesota, and she's ready to leave. And in her case, it's because she's not with a group of other teachers that embrace this notion of continuously learning and improving. And apparently her principal is not kind of driving that. So, and I realize that's, you know, that doesn't sound like a rule we need to change or and it isn't. It's really about the culture that exists in our buildings. And our conclusion from all of this is takes us back to principles. That is, the preparation of principles, because they're so vital in setting that sort of the cultural expectation in the building. But you're talking about someone who's supervising 30 to 50 people. So this isn't a gigantic enterprise, and their individual interactions with an individual teacher are going to have a huge impact on the quality of the experience that teacher has. I will tell you, though, something else that we talked about earlier this morning that Representative Dabney actually raised, and it got me thinking. You know, if we hire 25,000 of these people, these, you know, hard-charging change makers, they're going to change things. They're going to push back on a whole bunch of stuff. So they might say to us, you know, I'm okay with the standards, but don't tell me what order to teach them in. Or I'm okay with all these rules, but frankly, don't try to enforce them too hard. Give me more flexibility. Give me more openness to succeed. Because they're really great teachers. If you think back about your own time in school or go out and interview really great teachers, what they'll tell you is, I conform to all the rules that I have to, and then I go get my job done. Because they know that the success doesn't exist in the rules. It exists in their ability to customize their work to the students that are sitting in front of them. And I think we will hear, in my sense as a former superintendent, or you all as policymakers, I think if we get 25,000 of these hard chargers in our schools, we're going to get a lot of pushback about. Maybe you could do away with a bunch of that stuff. Give us an open field here, and we'll go get it done. But make the standards up, because these are hard chargers. They want challenging standards. They don't want to be part of anything that isn't first class. They don't want to be part of anything that doesn't challenge them professionally. And you know what? That's great.
Yep.
I want that person teaching my kids.
Representative Downey, follow up.
Oh, thank you, Mr.
Mr. Hutchinson, we have three more questions on this. Can you stick around a little bit past your 1:30
yep,
time frame?
Yep, we'll make it.
All right.
Representative, just so you all understand, I'm not just cutting out. I have actually board of directors meeting, and they're my bosses, and they expect me to show up.
Representative Klum.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hutchinson, I'm very
Representative Klum, can you use the mic, please, because we are on TV. So.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hutchinson, I'm very excited about what you're presenting, and I think it has wonderful implications for the future. However, I'm very concerned about the students now, and one of the concerns I have is that seniority and tenure prevent principals and superintendents from locating teachers where they need to be. In your page 9, it's very evident that it's key that we apply the resources applicably to the locations where they're needed. It's the chart that shows that there's not a great deal of effect in the middle and the high, but on the low end performers there's a huge effect what teachers they receive. And I'm wondering, the only thing that comes to mind that we can do now for the students that are in the classrooms at this time is to relieve the principals and the superintendents of the restrictions that seniority and tenure have on their ability to place teachers where they're needed to best provide for the students. Do you have any comment on that or any other ideas that may provide that relief to present-day students?
Mr. Hutchinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, a couple things. I'd say if there is a trend in Minnesota today, it is to open up the more of a debate in the inside school districts about how teachers get assigned to which schools. And that wasn't true when I was superintendent, so I actually see that as a positive, that there's much more discussion about this. One of the impediments we've had, though, is we haven't had good data on teacher effectiveness. So as this data comes forward, we're actually going to be in a better position to have this argument about which, not only philosophically whether it's a good idea, but which teachers are we talking about? And that will help all of us, I think, have a healthy discussion about wouldn't it make more sense to put our most effective teachers over here in this setting where we have the greatest challenges. I think we're going to have to think about supplementary compensation and other incentives to make that attractive to people, and we should. But with the data, I think we're actually going to be in a position to do that. The third thing is that if we're actually able to produce lots of great teachers, this become less of an issue. So I think there is a real incentive to try to make sure that there's a lot of really great teachers around so we're not fighting over the few. And then finally, one of the things we've started to talk to our partners about, the higher education partners, and they brought it up, is, okay, this is all great, you know, if we're able to design these programs for new teachers, but what could we do about the existing teachers? Is there not, can't we apply some of these same principles to the additional development of our existing teaching staff? And I see a lot of promise there as well. So I think there are things that we can start to do. But I think what's exciting for me as a former superintendent is we're actually talking about it, whereas in my day, we didn't even talk about it. We just sat around and knew it was true, but you couldn't even bring it up as an issue.
Mr. Chair, if I could supplement what Mr. Hutchinson said, it's not just the tenure issue, although we would agree with what you said, that they need to be loosened up. But it's also about data, as Mr. Hutchinson said earlier. I've got a son who's in fifth grade. He's going to sixth grade next year. I would like to be able to know, to look at the four sixth grade teachers at the next school and know what's been the results for the last 5 years for those four teachers. How have their students done? What's been the achievement? It's roughly the same demographic. So I'd like, as a parent, I'd like to know. But currently, you can't see that data. You can't see it. It's protected by either contract or state law. So that's one thing where you all can play a role is making that data public. I think if I have the right to look at a hospital or look at a car, or I'm going to go to surgery, I can evaluate the best hospital, I can evaluate the best auto dealer. I should be able to evaluate the best school. I should be able to evaluate the best teacher. And not necessarily for punishment or for tenure for being fired, but for helping them as well, for helping them get better. Let's help them figure out if they are struggling and they aren't having good results, let's figure out how to help them get there. But right now, no one knows, and certainly not the public.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Hutchinson. I appreciate your testimony. With regards to the kind of working with these institutions of higher learning and being perhaps a little more selective or looking for certain things with students interested in going into teaching or training for that, do you have a lot of data or a program developed and how you identify what you're looking for in those candidates? And is there anything that exists somewhere else in the world that you're looking at? And also looking at the information on how we seem to be preparing a lot more elementary education teachers than are going to be needed in a glut. Does that also get into looking for specific types of teachers and people that would be, you know, perhaps well-suited for the types of teachers we are going to be needing?
Mr. Hutchinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there's a lot of data. And I just quickly give you two pieces. So the one is there's always a fight about whether ACT or SAT scores matter. It turns out they matter some, not a ton. But they're actually relatively predictive when you're looking at, I think it's math scores as opposed to reading scores. So there is some evidence that higher SAT scores would be a good thing. But the best evidence actually is looking at the actual sort of behavior of people. So that's why I said the presidents of the clubs, the heads of the organizations, the organizers on campus, it's real clear that people with those behaviors, those people with that outlook, make great teachers. Not every one of them, and we don't need every one of them, but a significant percentage do. The second thing that we've learned from the research, and especially if you compare us, and Charlie raised this, compare us with other countries, most other countries do their selection before they let people into the teaching profession. We do the reverse. We let everybody in and then try to sort it out at the end. And there's a lot to be said, and that's why I love about our prep programs. They want to be more selective in bringing people in, but they also want to get them in class, real classrooms right away so that those people can decide real quickly, do I really like kids? Do I really like teaching? Because you don't want to find that out in your junior or senior year. You want to know that early on so that we can do some of the process of helping people select themselves out early, and also give them hands-on experience so we can see whether they have that combination that it's going to take to be successful. Now, ultimately, that they got to get hired someplace, so having data on their academic experience and their own demonstration of effectiveness will be important. And the Board of Teaching here is doing some very important work on something called the Teacher Performance Assessment, which would be an assessment at the end of their college experience that tests whether or not they're actually effective in classrooms. And I think that discussion of tenure raises a really important question about, you know, shouldn't tenure ultimately be based on demonstrations of effectiveness in the classroom, not just time and place? And if we put all of those pieces together, I think we actually can sort through this. And maybe in the end, our teacher preparation programs are smaller or produce fewer teachers, but produce all the ones we need, and that they're really good, and stay longer. I think that's what we want to try to get to, is more focus, more success, and then more longevity, and we'd have a much better education.
We've got two more questioners, and he's got four more minutes, so quick, Representative Loon.
Well, my other question is more for Mr. Weaver, so I can withhold it.
Okay. Representative Bills, like I said, 4 minutes, and they got one questioner after you, so quick, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hutchinson, is the Department of Education institutionally capable of storing and mining the data that you're talking about with the value added? Because it just seems like a massive amount of data, and I was wondering if there was a public-private or private models that are better able to you know, with the capital equipment that they have, to leverage the resources that you have, that you obtain.
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't know the answer, but I do know I need to find out, because we're making a multi-million dollar investment in creating this data capability, and again, we don't own and operate things, so somehow, once we get this created, it's got to reside somewhere. At the moment, it's going to be residing at the University of Wisconsin. I'm not sure that's a good idea either. but it's kind of how we got there, right?
Especially since they owe us $58 million.
It's a very volatile border.
Yeah. So thanks.
So it's a great question. I don't know the answer, but I tell you, we are thinking hard about it because we've got to get it somewhere, and it's got to last.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Dietrich, you're the last one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make a comment and then a question. First of all, I know many of the colleagues that I have talked to in the last 2 years have found this model refreshing. It actually goes to the source of the problem instead of trying to nibble around the edges and find every other problem except for going to the real source of the problem and trying to reform that. So I think this whole idea of reforming the pipeline is the right direction. The question that I have is, so this was, you, Representative Weaver, you've been in our spots before. This is what we do. We listen to good testimony, and every time somebody walks away and we go, that was really great. I want to know, where are you at, and when can we expect the graduates starting to come out of the pipeline so that we know when we have made a change, and there is a change, and what to account that change to. So, thank you.
Mr. Hutchinson.
The first graduates will actually graduate next year, but they'll be the first. So I think about this like whipping up a new recipe for cookies. This will be the first batch that comes out, and it's not all going to be perfect. But they'll be out there. We'll be able to see how they do. We'll learn from their experience. The biggest batches will come really 2 or 3 years from now because they're just being admitted. The new students are just coming in. So, we're launching this, we're going to launch this big statewide recruiting program this spring, which is intended to drive people to the teaching programs enrolling this fall. And some of those programs are 2 years programs, some are three, and some are four. So over that period of time, we'll start to see these graduates coming out. So we'll know a lot about who decides to come into the programs in the next year. That's a big deal from my point of view. Is it any different? Is the class that enrolls this fall any different from the class that enrolled last fall? If they're not, we're probably not making much progress. So we'll have that, and then a year from then, we'll have these first enrollees in classrooms as part of their educational experience, and we'll get our first inklings about some qualitative measures about their ability to teach. We won't have all of it, but we'll start to see whether or not these different young people put in a classroom setting, given an educational objective for the day, whether they can deliver, so it's going to be quite a lot of learning as we go along. And not us. I mean, it's the higher eds that are going to be doing all this learning and the K-12s. And this gets me, if I might, Mr. Chairman, to kind of one closing pitch. The challenge here is, the excitement here is I've run into 14 university presidents that are willing to stick their necks way out. And, they're not required to do this. I mean, their lives could be perfectly happy if they kept their heads down and just prayed like the Dickens for something not too bad to happen to them. But these 14 have said, no, we'll stick our necks out. We'll actually say we're going to do this. We'll say we'll guarantee the effectiveness of these teachers. We'll make a commitment to the K-12 schools. We'll hold ourselves accountable. And good for them, right? And we're investing resources to help them with the transformation. So we're an investor. We're not an operator. These are not operating dollars. They're not teaching a single candidate using our dough. They're trying to revamp their curriculum and build these partnerships and so on. What they need, I mean, here's the problem with courageous change makers. Sometimes you're the only one. Sometimes your neck is way out there and you look behind you and there's nobody there. Or your faculty starts pushing back, or your colleagues say you're out of your mind, and the thing they need, they're getting it, and we're giving them as much as we can, but I got to tell you, you can be helpful. They need signals, they need signs, they need support, they need encouragement, they need to be rewarded for being willing to do this, because they're actually not required to do this. It's the right thing to do, it's the ethical thing to do. The fact that they're doing it, the Bush Foundation only gets so far, right? I mean, we look like an ATM machine to most people. So
we can get so far, but if we don't together create the kind of policy environment that literally encourages this behavior, we ain't going to get there. And we're talking about changing a system. So it's not going to happen overnight, but it will happen if we create enough sort of pieces of reinforcement so that they get encouraged to keep going forward and, frankly, are prevented from going back. And if we can get both those things happening, I got to tell you, we got something we can look forward to.
Well, Mr. Hutchinson, Mr. Weaver, thank you very much for your testimony today, and we look forward to hearing from you in the future. And next we have AMSD, Association of Metropolitan School Districts. Well, specifically Scott. But now, while we're doing the transition here, Mr. Krell and Mr. Strom, there was we had referenced some census data in a previous committee hearing, and I believe there's been an update of that information. I'm wondering if you guys could, if either one of you could run through the update of that census information.
Mr. Chair, committee members, the census, U.S. Census is one group that publishes a whole variety of statistics. One of theirs is an education funding statistic that looks just at the state share of education out of each state's general fund budget. There was a dramatic drop in the 2009 number for Minnesota, which prompted a number of newspaper comments and articles. Turns out the census had left out the higher education portion of Minnesota's education budget, which explained that big drop. So the number of the state being ranked 44th was reflective of that chunk missing. When the higher ed budget's added back in, the rank is 7th. What this number is just simply the portion of Minnesota's direct budget that it spends on K-12 education. There are a variety of other measures of school funding and school funding changes over time. A lot of these state-by-state comparisons can be found on the National Center for Education Statistics website. They'll look at spending as a percent of, on a per-pupil basis, on a percent of GDP or income per state and that kind of measure. So there's a variety of other ways to compare school funding as well, but the one that the census used showed the percent of state funding that it was for education as a percent of the total state budget.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Strom. Since we're on TV and people might think we're seventh, though, if you look at other studies, Mr. Strom, would you say, taking all of them into sort of an average, that we're middling, or have we sunk lower than that on average?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, the majority of those measures we tend to be in the middle of. They tend to have very tight distributions. So a relative space, for instance, if Minnesota were to gone from 21st to 25th or 27th to 20th place, it could be a movement of a few hundred dollars per student because many states are clustered right at the middle there. I haven't looked at the most recent version of that data, but I'd be happy to provide you that state-by-state comparison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think in the 44th is definitely not what we want to put out there, but neither is 7th.
Well, Representative Greiling, the only purpose I brought it up is because that people have been using that number repeatedly over and over, and I wanted to make sure that we had accurate information. And as we've discussed earlier in this committee, education funding is an exceptionally complex issue. Sometimes where you stand, you know, what you see depends upon where you sit. And so the dialogue will continue, but just with regards to that statistic, I know there was a lot of media coverage, a lot of exposure. It was being repeated prominently by many individuals, both public policy experts and otherwise, and just wanted to make sure we got that accurate information out there.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Strom, can you provide us with that link?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, yes, I'd be happy
Thank
to
you.
Do so.
Thank you. And, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. We represent 33 independent or special school districts, 3 intermediate school districts in the metro area, and 3 integration districts. About 46% of the students in the state attend one of our member districts. I appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chairman, and committee members, to share a few items from our legislative platform with you. And you should have had it. It's the handout that looks like this, the blue handout. And then inside of that, there was another handout, a budget survey document. Mr. Chairman and members, we really start putting our legislative platform together probably a few months after the last legislative session ended. It's a lengthy process. We really try to get a lot of input from our member districts, and that includes superintendents, school board members, and other school staff. We hold a series of meetings and around the metro area and to try to make sure that our platform is representative of all of our members. Of course, we take a lot of things into account, and one of the considerations as we were developing this platform was, not surprisingly, the state budget situation. When we really started putting it together, it was before the November forecast, but it was pretty clear already that the situation was not going to be real bright, so we tried to keep that in mind as we developed our platform. But at the same time, we felt it was very important for us to keep in mind the condition of our school districts. And so with that, I turn your attention to this budget survey document. This was a survey that was conducted over the fall and was updated as recently as January 4th, so it is very recent data. What we asked in this survey was we asked our member districts to, on the far left-hand column, to indicate what their budget reserve reduction was for the current year. So that is telling you how much did they spend on their budget reserves. And, of course, that's to try to offset some of the cuts that they otherwise would have to make. You do the same thing as you know at the state level. That's why we have budget reserves. They call them rainy day funds, and when it's raining, you use them. And as you all know, it's been more than raining lately. The next column is the actual budget reductions. And these are the reductions that were made in the current year. And so if you go down to the bottom of those two, you'll see fund balances were spent down by almost $44 million, and then just about $91 million in actual budget reductions were made in our member school districts. That translated into 824 layoffs, staff layoffs, in our 33 regular or special school districts. The far right column is a projection, and what we asked our members to assume there is assume current law. So just assume you're going to get the level of funding that's required right now or is outlined right now. So no cuts, no increases, flat funding. And then also just assume you're not going to try to add any new programs. You're just going to try to continue to do what you're doing right now, trying to offer the same programs. So again, you can see the district by district results. But if you go down to the bottom, you'll see that our districts under that scenario are projecting that they would be facing over $153 million in budget reductions. So we just provide that as a source of information, Mr. Chairman and members, not meant to sound whiny. That's just what it is. It is what it is, and those are the projections. And that's the backdrop against what we of which we developed our platform. And with that, I just walk you through that. And I won't go through every item on here, Mr. Chairman. There's many of them. I'll try just to pick out a few. You can see the first heading that is listed is stabilized funding. And I guess this is one area that we would have a difference with the previous testimony you heard today, is that saying that we have a stable funding system in Minnesota. We don't think that is the case. We think we've actually have a system that has left us on quite a bit of a roller coaster. We're in the third year now where the general ed formula is at the same level, so it has not increased, as I mentioned, in the third year, consecutive year now. And that puts a tremendous strain, as our budget survey shows, on school districts. You'll notice the first, the bullet, we're not asking you to raise the general education formula, even though it is has been frozen. And that, of course, is in recognition of the state's budget. But we are asking you to do everything you can to maintain it at its current level and to avoid making reductions. The next bullet I do want to point to, and that is we're asking you to consider this session, and probably spend more time on this later, but to give your school boards the ability to renew an existing referendum. All right, so, and that's the key word there is existing, so it's not a new, could not be a tax increase, could only be at the same rate. But we are in a situation where we have frozen state funding, and many of our school districts now rely on 15 to 20% of their operating revenue from their local referendum. So you can imagine that if we would have a situation where an existing referendum came up for a vote and failed, the result for that school district would be, I don't think catastrophic is really too strong a word. It would be that kind of impact for a school district. We're certainly willing to work with any of you on that provision. If there's parameters you would want to put around that, have it sunset after a few years, or, you know, there's other ideas that some of you maybe have brought forward, but what we view it as is a measure to try to help us get through this crisis until the state gets back on sounder financial footing. You've touched on several of the other bullets below here in previous from previous groups, but I will just briefly touch on, you'll notice that we do recommend that we eliminate the $25 per pupil penalty for not having contracts settled on time. We just think that doesn't make sense to penalize students when the adults don't get the job done. And the result is, if you're going to penalize a district $25, students are going to be impacted. That's revenue lost to that school district, and there's no way around it. It's going to have an impact on student programming. We would recommend that you replace it with a system that's used by other employees that are classified as essential employees. And I want to say this clearly for the record. Our board members do not in any way, shape, or form view this as an anti-teacher recommendation. In fact, quite the opposite. We're recognizing that our teachers are essential. We can't have school without them. And, you know, not having education going on is just not, should not be an option. And the reality is that under this scenario, the vast majority of those contracts would still be settled through the collective bargaining process. It's only when there was an impasse would you then move into the arbitration process. We think it works for other employee groups, and we think it could work in education as well. There's a few others there, Mr. Chairman, but as I mentioned, you've talked about some of those, so I'll move over to the next heading. Adopting initiatives to close the achievement gap. You all know it. It's a persistent problem in Minnesota, one we've got to address. A couple of the bullet items under there. One recommendation we have is looking at establishing an early learning levy. That would not be our first choice as to how to fund early education programs. But again, this is in recognition of the state's financial condition. And if we're going to do something in the near term, then possibly an early learning levy would be the only way we could get the ball rolling. Expanding the extended time program, and the one that ties in with that is allowing school boards to determine their calendar, one that many of you are familiar with. We actually think the whole Labor Day issue is really an old argument, and one that we really probably shouldn't even be talking about. We need to be talking about other things like year-round school, you know, extended day, time, week. We think the data is pretty strong that the summer learning loss is the major contributor to the achievement gap. I've mentioned the study before, and some of you are familiar with it, but Johns Hopkins University had a major study in the Baltimore Public Schools that showed that in the Baltimore Public Schools, summer learning loss was attributable to 66%. Let me rephrase that, Mr. Chairman. 66% of the achievement gap was directly attributable to summer learning loss. What they found was that the achievement gap during the school year was narrowing, and then we get to summer, and the kids aren't in school half of June, July, and August, and not only does that achievement gap spring back to where it was, it actually even widens further. And the reasons are pretty obvious. It's because the students from the middle to upper income families are going to, their parents are going to make sure they have those opportunities in the summer. They're going to do the, you know, the field trips, the summer camps, the you name it. And of course, for the poor students, the at-risk students, that just doesn't happen. So we think that's just an issue that has to be addressed. I'll skip to the next heading, Mr. Chairman, increased teacher administrator effectiveness. You just heard a lot about that. And we think the initiative by the Bush Foundation is tremendous. Many of our members, our teachers, our superintendents, administrators are involved in working in that effort. And we fully support it. We think it's transformational, the work that's going on there. We've got some bullet items here that, once again, you've already talked about, the alternative pathways, the teacher evaluations. Say two-thirds of our members are involved, are participating in the QCOMP or the ATPPS system. We support that. We think it's something that you should continue. You'll note that one amendment we would recommend there is just tweaking that formula so that intermediate school districts would also be able to participate in that program. The way it's funded, the way it's designed right now, it really doesn't work for the intermediate districts. And finally, Mr. Chairman, I just turned to the last page, and that's transforming the current funding system. And this is more the long range. visionary piece, I guess, of our platforms. We recognize that given the state funding situation, we're going to have to look at phasing in a lot of that. We still think that the new Minnesota Miracle System that's been developed over the last several years provides a foundation that you could work from. Certainly could be amended. But you see some of the bullets underneath that heading that we think should be part of that. Online learning is emerging incredibly fast and is a train that's just moving down the track. Mr. Chairman, one that you've worked on extensively, expanding opportunities for students to graduate from high school early. We think that's something that we really should be looking at. And I already mentioned the fact that we need to look at really, rather than having 2.5 months off in the summer, we need to move towards a system where we have learning opportunities available year-round all the time. So I'll stop there, Mr. Chairman. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Just a couple of quick questions regarding the budget survey documents. Does that include federal stabilization dollars in those numbers?
It does, Mr. Chairman. Yep, that would be included in there.
How about the Mr. Greenquist? How about the second round in the fall? I don't know what they call it. The second round of federal money that went to the school districts. What do we,
Mr. Chairman? Yeah, the EduJobs money. Or
yeah,
No, everything was included. You realize, I think, that those were one-time funds, and so they will disappear. Different districts have made different decisions on how they're using those. Some hired some positions back already this year. Some decided they're going to wait and maybe use the bulk of those funds to try to mitigate cuts next year.
And with regards to the estimated budget gap for the fiscal year 12 with a 0% increase, does the 0% include, you know, we have the state money and we have the federal money. And from the school district's perspective, obviously, they view it as one blob. For state accounting purposes, it's much different. In that number, is that assumed the increase in the state's commitment with regards to filling in the stabilization pothole, the increase in student counts, the increase in compensatory counts? Are those all those increased state expenditures, are those built into that 0% number?
Mr. Chairman, members, yes, they would be. We asked them to assume current law. So whatever, basically the November forecast, we're asking them to use that assumption.
Okay, thank you. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kronquist, I have a couple questions. Thank you for bringing up a number of items that I wanted to ask you about. And I agree with you that QComp should be available for all the students in the state of Minnesota, not just for a few that have the ability to apply for it and put that money to use for their students, but all students in the state of Minnesota. Second thing, Mr. Kronquist, I want to disagree with you on the extended year time. Obviously, depending upon where you live in the state of Minnesota, when you start school, it makes a huge impact, does make a huge impact on the local economy, on local jobs, on a local for a number of local issues. But, Mr. Kronquist, I am excited about the opportunity to see the pilot program that was established last year by the previous commissioner, allowing some districts in the southern part of the state to have an early start date and to look at if, in fact, the achievement gap closes. So I'll be looking at that closely. I hope all of us will be looking at that closely to see if, in fact, the outcomes show those results. So I'll be looking forward to that as well. But let me go to your budget survey. The reserve reduction, that does not, let me rephrase this. The reductions, like, for example, Rosemount, Representative Bill's district, had $11,400,000 in reductions. That is on top of the reserves spent down, correct? So you would add both of those down together to make sure that for the reductions in that district, in each district, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ward, that is correct. Yeah, you'd have to add those first two columns together to get what the total budget reduction was.
And I wanted to make that clear.
Thank you.
The last thing, could you tell us how the property or how the shifts impacted those figures, impacted those reductions? Was a lot of it due to the shifts? Or just give us an indication of how the shifts impacted that, please.
Mr. Kronquist.
Mr. Chairman, committee members. The shifts have an impact. Every district is impacted, as you know. It's in one of two ways. Either you are having to spend down your budget reserves and you're going to lose some interest income that you otherwise would have realized, Or if you were a district that didn't have a sufficient reserves in the first place, you actually are going to have to short-term borrow, and then you're going to incur some interest costs. So, yeah, it does have an impact. Our member districts estimated that the shift cost them a little over $5 million last year. And, again, that was a combination of either the lost interest income or the interest cost.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gumquist, I was wondering, could you augment, you know, send out to us the actual year-to-year dollars so we can see, you know, what that change was, and then the, you know, just the total dollar spent each year, and then the three major drivers of this $153 million gap between, you know, with zero growth, I look at that as, you know, level. So you've got $153 million increase in what you're needing. Can you let us know the three drivers of that $153-plus million increase in your spending?
Mr. Krumquist, before we take Representative Quam's request, maybe it just might be better. I know we have a spreadsheet out there that tracks school district year-to-year spending. Would it be better to have members refer to House staff for that? Would that be helpful? Or I'm not sure if do you guys have that. Otherwise, do you have that information readily available? Or
actually, Mr. Chairman, that's exactly where we would go for it as well, the same spreadsheet that your staff would use that we get from the department. So
if perhaps if these are Representative Quam, you know, Mr. Krumquist can work with House staff and get that to you. Otherwise, we can
right. Basically, basically augmenting this to get a more complete picture in one package as opposed to running everywhere to compile it.
Mr. Strom, Mr. Crow, would that be is that a possibility?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Crow and I were just talking about this. There is spending data collected through the UFAR system, and that lags by a year and a half or 2 years. So we currently have fiscal year 2009 spending data. So when we look at spending data, we can give you lots of historical data up through 2009. For revenue estimates, we can use spreadsheets to project out to the end of the next biennium on a revenue front, but we don't have all the categories of revenue in. We've got the major categories of revenue, and we'd be happy to put those in a way that summarizes what we expect those revenue trends to be over the next few years. The issue is sort of the quantity of data and how to get that in a form that's most helpful to you. But we'd certainly be happy to put together a small spreadsheet on a district-by-district basis that shows revenue for the last year and for the next 4 years and on a total major source of revenue.
And Mr. Strom, you're saying we don't have fiscal year 10 yet?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the Department of Education waits for school districts to finish their audited books before they post the fiscal year 10 audited data, and that's just about done, but usually it takes till about March for that to get onto the web. So for purposes of looking at detailed expenditure information, fiscal year 2009 is the last we have available.
Representative Fahm, does that understand that?
That's good. The only other item is percent of reserve balance. Having been a former treasurer for a school board, you know, we would spend up and down, so it'd be nice to understand, yeah, they spent the money, but what are the present balances? And
Mr. Krumquist, did you want to elaborate on that? Or
yep. And Mr. Chairman and Representative Quam, and that would be all over the map, as you know. I mean, it varies greatly by school district. Some are have very limited fund balances. We have one district that's in statutory operating debt, has been for 6 years, and then we have others that have a little healthier fund balance, but rapidly dwindling. So, and then to answer your other question, Mr. Chairman, Representative Quam, we left it to each district to use their own assumptions in terms of on the expenditure side, but you know, not surprisingly, the overwhelming percent of funding that a school district spends is on labor. So, you know, each district would have built in a different assumption there, but that would have been the number one cost driver. They would have been making some assumptions on health insurance costs and wage costs. And then probably the second biggest one would be energy costs. And I think any of you that have stopped to fill up your tank lately understand what some of the cost pressures are there. And then you had heating fuel on top of that. And so those are costs that are largely outside the control of school districts, but they try to anticipate what they're going to be.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll maybe ask two questions in one for sake of time. Mr. Kroonquist, on your spreadsheet here, this FY 2011 budget reductions column, what is the starting date and ending date of your definition of FY 2011 budget reductions? And part B of the question is, when districts were setting those budgets, would they not have known what their state funding was with certainty at the point that they set that budget?
Mr. Kroonquist.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, yeah, school districts are on the same fiscal calendar as the state, so it's the July 1st to June 30th. So the fiscal 11 reductions is the current school year that we're in right now. So those are the reductions that school districts made to balance their budgets in this current school year that we're in.
Just a comment and an observation, and maybe it's an offline conversation because I was never on a school board to know how all these things work. But what it appears to me is that these school districts, for whatever reason, had cost variables in their budgets that they couldn't control or they just overspent. But it seems to me every single one of these budgets would have been set initially knowing fully what the state funding and what their own funding was. I mean, maybe there were referenda that didn't pass or some considerations, but I'm just a little shocked that they would have had to cut their budgets when they set those budgets in the first place, fully knowing what their state funding was. And so maybe it's an offline conversation where you can educate me.
Mr. Kroonquist.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, yeah, it's not a situation where they had established a budget and then went in and made reductions. These are the reductions they made from the previous year in order to bring their fiscal 2011 budget into balance.
Representative Downey.
So are those... are those budget reductions kind of the same way the state does it, where you take what your projected spending is and then what you come at is called a reduction? And maybe this is to Representative Kwan's question, too. What was the actual spending? And maybe we'll see that in the data. But maybe just real quickly, is that how you count a reduction or a budget cut? Same way, whatever the projection was, if you had to reduce from that projection, you'd call that a reduction here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, it's showing what the reductions the school district had to make from its previous budget, and just trying to keep the same programs moving forward the next year.
Yep. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kroonquist, on the topic you raised on the year-round learning programs, have you had any, how would that program be envisioned, or how far along are you in talking about it? What about cost estimates? And have you talked to teachers, for example, about if they would be willing to teach a couple months, take a month off? How far along are those talks?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, they are really conceptual, I mean, at this point, because obviously cost is a huge factor, and it's very expensive to add on time to the calendar. But there are discussions, many districts are talking about maybe you don't even necessarily add to the number of days, but you look at a different calendar. And this is just, this was an idea that was just really thrown out, and I would not want to say that it's being seriously considered, but you know a number of districts have gone to the four-day week during these budgetary times. I think we have 11 districts now in the state. And it was a brainstorming session. We had one of our superintendents say, well, what if everybody went to a four-day week? And then we went through June, or however long you needed, in order to meet the time requirements that we have in statute. But then you used that fifth day, though, still as a learning day, whether it's through online learning or community ed. That's just one example of the ideas that people are starting to think about just because of the issues that do arise with the summer learning loss.
Representative Bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Grunquist, do you have any estimate or be able to provide hard numbers maybe later of what's the tracking of losses on the $25 per pupil penalty when the contracts aren't settled? Do we know numbers or maybe the chair or research has numbers to what districts have lost historically year to year?
Yeah, Representative Bills, I consult staff on this, but I think last year it was about $2.5 million. Mr. Crow, Mr. Strom, what was the, is that right?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bills, that's right, and we can give you that information on a historic basis. Previous years it hasn't been that high, and but we can give you a detailed year-by-year breakdown of what's happened on that penalty.
And Brent, if you could share that with the entire committee, that'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Phil. Thank you, Mr. Grunquist, and for providing a very nice laid-out plan here. It's very nice to get one.
Thank you. Appreciate
it. All right. Members, with that, just one quick thing. Please monitor your emails. As we've discussed before, we've been talking about the idea of taking a field trip, and one of the things we're looking at right now is we just might have members carpool to a couple of different schools to do that. It doesn't look like the committee budget process has been set as soon as I would have expected or known. So we just might have members drive there. If that's if members feel uncomfortable with that, just please let me know offline, and otherwise we can delay it. But with that, this committee is adjourned. Everyone have a great weekend.